Okay, so chapter 9, verses 16 to 18. In these verses, Koheleth examines the details of the event. So wisdom was better than force. It defeated it. Nevertheless, this foolish ruler was the problem. So therefore, wisdom is better than force, even though it sometimes happens that wise words are despised and rejected. Also, the words of the wise are listened to with greater pleasure than the shouts of a foolish ruler. Nevertheless, one fool can still destroy much good that comes from wisdom. And again, this doesn't mean that one shouldn't be wise, but rather we should be wise. So what he's addressing is this wise man saves the city, and yet he's despised and not listened to and kind of ignored, right? So you can imagine you might be thinking, well, what's the point of being wise, right? What did you really do? You're not really any better off. And what he's saying is, no, you still are. He still did a good thing. You should be wise because it's better than being a mighty ruler. However, it sometimes happens that foolish rulers can destroy the good of this wisdom. So if we go back to our basketball analogy, did anyone's bracket make it out of the first round, incidentally? I think in the second game I was out, so that shows how well I know the future. Okay, so if you imagine this bracket, though, or these basketball games, let's say you work really hard and practice before a big game, but you end up losing that game to a team that you would normally beat or a team that's ranked worse than you, right? This doesn't mean that you shouldn't practice and work hard to win. It just means that sometimes you lose even though you worked hard and did everything you could. Okay, there's a sort of a modern day analogy. Or like if you play video games or something, it's probably the same thing. I don't know. All right. To summarize that, chapter 9, verse 11 to 18, be wise even though it might not seem to pay off all the time. Know that it's better to be wise than powerful and mighty, even though your good works can be destroyed by a foolish ruler. Okay. Would someone read Philippians 3, 13 to 16? I think we read this last time. Alakai, Philippians 3, 13 to 16. Just be patient, Charlotte. Wait over there with the microphone.
Philippians 3, 13 to 16.
Correct. And so as he's reading this, just remember what he's doing is looking to the future. He's not looking to the past. He's looking to growth and maturing into the image of Christ, okay? Okay, speak a little louder and hold the microphone a little further away.
Okay. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Therefore let us, as many as are mature, have this mind, and if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal even this to you. Nevertheless, to the degree that we have already attained, let us walk by the same rule, let us be of the same mind.
Okay, so keep striving, keep working, even though sometimes when you're wise and work hard, it seems like you lost because of it or you didn't gain. Make sense? Okay. All right, so moving on then to the next chapter. And as we look at this chapter, did everyone have a chance to sign up for this? This is the brunch next Sunday. I'll just pass it around. If you've already signed up or whatever, just pass it on. But I told Holly I would pass that around, so. Okay, in this next chapter, the theme, you could say, is the outsized impact of small things on the outcome. Okay? I like this chapter a lot. Not that that matters, but just it's interesting to think about those small details that end up really changing and shaping things. So as we read this, keep that in mind. That's kind of the overarching theme of the chapter. And it takes off right from the end of the previous chapter, which is one fool can destroy much good. And then it starts in chapter one, a dead fly makes sweet ointment stinkingly to ferment. A little folly is more mighty than honorable wisdom. So Koheleth has just told a story of how one fool ruined much good. And next in chapter 10, he elaborates on the minor impact that small things can have. I'll read all three of the verses. A dead fly makes sweet ointment stinkingly to ferment. A little folly is more mighty than honorable wisdom. Still, the mind of the wise man is at his right hand, but the mind of the fool at his left. And even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks his mind. And yet, he says of everyone, he is a fool. Okay, so it's far easier, that another way of phrasing this might be, it's far easier to destroy than to create, as we all know who have children, right? They can go around the house and make a mess very quickly, and it takes like five times as long to clean it up, right? Same idea, a little evil outweighs a lot of good, okay? A little carelessness destroys a lot of careful work. In this verse, it's a foolish impulse that's the problem. A small foolish action destroys much wisdom. This could be within a group, as we saw at the end of chapter 9, but it can also be within our own individual lives. Our own foolish actions can cancel a lot of good. So I thought of an example. If you're leaving a job that, let's say, you'd worked hard at for many years, and you get upset about something, and you leave telling everyone what you think of them in the moment, okay? How do you think you'll be remembered? Will it be for the years of service, or will also that one outburst at the end really overshadow a lot of what you did all those years, okay? And that's partly what he's addressing in the next section that we'll get to, when a ruler his anger is kindled against you, what should you do? And the rest of the chapter sort of flushes that out. It's kind of a horrible phrase. Okay, there are two main views to this verse. In verse 2, still the mind of the wise man is at his right hand, but the mind of the fool is at his left. So Jake, could you look up Psalm 16:8? And Mr. Olsgaard, do you have your Bible with you? Psalm 110, verse 5. And then, Ed, if you would, Psalm 60, verse 5. Okay, Mr. Hopper.
16:8, correct?
Yes. Let me read a little bit first, and then I'll tell you when to start. Okay. So there are two views on this verse, and the views center around what does it mean to be at your right hand versus being at your left. Okay, so the first view is, I think, how the ESV is translated, and that is that the right and left stand for lucky and unlucky, or good and bad. So if you were to take that reading, then the wise are inclined to good, and the fool is inclined to bad. Okay? That does not make as good a sense to me as view two. And I'll show you why by reading a couple of these Psalms, okay? And the second view is that to be at one's right indicates to stand by one, to be ready to assist or to defend. So, Jake, if you would, Psalm 16:8.
I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken.
So what do you think being at your right hand means in that sense?
Well, in this sense, he's talking about his surety because the Lord is with him, is near him.
To be near one, to come to his aid, to help him, right? Okay. Mr. Olsgaard, Psalm 110, verse 5.
The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings in the day of his wrath.
Okay. So again, the idea is that God's there next to you. He's with you. He's there to help you. He's going to do these things for you. Okay. And so much so that this idea, the idea that being at one's right hand is meant to indicate this person is there to assist you becomes such a common thing that it results in your right hand itself being used as a means of delivery, okay? And you could see that in Ed's verse, Psalm 60, verse 5. Yeah. So if we take that reading, then you end up with an understanding of this passage, something like this. The mind of the wise man is a faithful help in times of need. It is there to defend and stand by him to deliver him. Oh, that's okay, sweetie. Okay, so even though the mind of the wise is not guaranteed to succeed at all times because of the outside influence of folly, it is nevertheless a faithful help. Okay? So then to be at the right hand is to be ready to assist, to help. To be at the left hand then means the reverse, which is it's not there to help. It's not there when it's needed. And this fits with the next verse that we'll see, where we see the fool who's missing his mind. His mind is not there when it's needed. It's absent. Okay? So I'll read that verse again. Still, the mind of the wise man is at his right hand, but the mind of the fool is at his left. Verse 3, and even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks his mind, and yet he says of everyone, he's a fool. Okay. So to summarize, verse 1 and 2, even though the fool can destroy much good and a little foolishness is mightier than wisdom, it is still true that the mind of the wise is there to guide and direct him, while the mind of the fool is not. So verse 3 that I just read, the expression walks on the road is used to indicate doing the most basic or simplest things that one would do in public. So the idea is that the fool cannot hide his want of wisdom. It is so glaring that everyone sees it as soon as the fool leaves his house and sets his foot on the road to go somewhere. And yet he, that is the fool, thinks everyone else the fool. This is rather ironic, right? The fool is the one who thinks he's smarter than everyone else. The wise person is the one who humbles himself and listens to advice. So in retrospect, however, this makes perfect sense. If we don't listen to others and change our behavior and learn, how will we get better and grow? It's like if I were to take piano lessons, but I didn't want to listen to my teacher because what he or she's saying doesn't make sense to me, right? It doesn't make sense to me because my thinking needs to change. I need to change how I think in order to grow. I need to acknowledge that I don't know how to play the piano in this case, but that I could learn from others who actually do. And when I do this, then I start to grow in wisdom. But if I continue to see myself as superior to others or can't learn anything from others, I remain foolish and don't grow. So it's the same thing with God's word. We need to change our thinking and the way we view our lives to conform to the Word of God, not interpret the Word of God to fit how we think. Okay, I'm going to read a couple of Proverbs, but JP, if you could look up Proverbs 10:8, and would anyone else like to read? Thank you, Stephen. Proverbs 12:15. Okay, I'll read one real quick. Proverbs 1:7 and 1:32. Okay, Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Right, so the fool looks at others and thinks that person's foolish. They can't teach me anything. So 1:32, the simple are killed by their turning away, and the complacency of fools destroys them. But whoever listens to me will dwell secure and will be at ease without dread of disaster. Okay, JP.
All right. 10:8, the wise of heart will receive commandments, but a babbling fool will come to ruin.
Mm-hmm. So you get on the one hand the wise who actually listen and receive instruction, and the other one is just talking, right? He's telling you what he thinks and what his explanation is, but he's not following the commandment. Yeah? Steven?
Yep. All right, 12:15. The way of a fool is, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice.
Right. So how would you, what would you say the fool's thinking there, Stephen? What's his mindset?
Kind of trusting in himself, mm-hmm. That his ways are right, kind of an arrogance, I guess, that he's, you know, he doesn't need to listen to anybody else.
Yeah. Right. It's just like our fool in Ecclesiastes. He's walking down the road, displaying to everyone in the way that he's living that he's a fool, and yet he turns and looks at them. He's like, oh, that guy's a fool. Look at what he's doing. Okay? Proverbs 15:5, just a few more to show you the... ironicness? There's got to be a better word than that. Irony, sorry. it's a little too long. okay, so the irony in that, it's, okay, 15:5. A fool despises his father's instruction, but whoever heeds reproof is prudent. 18:2, a fool, this is one of my favorites, a fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion, which it goes in line with JP's. The fool is the one who's talking, telling you what his opinion is. He's not the one being quiet, listening, and learning. Okay? All right. So this is the idea captured in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes. Sorry, verse 3. Chapter 4. Verse 4. Thank you. If you want to be humble, just stand up here and teach. I'll tell you that much. Okay. Verse 4, chapter 10. If the anger of the ruler is kindled against you, do not quit your place, for gentleness prevents greater outrages. Okay, so to quit your place would be a sudden surrendering of your post or office. This is similar to the idea in chapter 8, verse 3. Do not go away hastily from his presence. Do not stand up because of an evil word, for he does whatever pleases him. That's the tyrant from before. Okay, similar idea. The phrase greater errors or outrages here in our verse does not refer to the offenses of the subject, but is the same as an evil word in verse 3 and characterizes the ill treatment from the ruler. So in other words, if the ruler becomes angry with you, do not be quick to leave, for gentleness calms his anger and prevents even greater outrage from being greater outrages from being committed. So if you stay and endure, you can prevent even worse things from happening, which is what he describes in the next few verses. And if we go back to our, well, I'll just read this. So verses 5-7, there is an evil which I've seen under the sun, an outrage as that which proceeds from a ruler. A great fool is placed in many high positions, and the noble sit in degradation. I have seen servants upon horses and masters walking on the ground as servants. Okay, so in other words, a fool left unchecked can destroy the entire system. It's as if Koheleth is saying, if all the wise people left their posts, what would keep this thing from happening? Fools being in high positions and nobles degraded, the entire authority structure turned upside down. Obviously, if all the wise left their posts, this is what would happen. So in contrast to this, Koheleth reminds us of God's sovereignty and how it is woven into the very fabric of his creation, which is what he looks at next. Do you have a question?
Just something I observed. So yeah. Well, two quick points that stand out to me. One, a theme going through all the way through the end of chapter 9, but also chapter 10, is the theme of a ruler, a great ruler who's defeated by a wise man in a small city. What to do if you offend a ruler, and what happens if you have unworthy rulers? Like, this is coming from Solomon. You know what I mean? Yeah. So here's a man who knows what it is to be a great king and who knows what it is to rule. So I just love that, the way that ties in. And also, I really love the way that 5, 6, and 7 completely goes against the impulse of our modern Western culture, who thinks it would always be better if the lowest were put in positions of high authority, right? That's what,
right.
I mean, that's what would be fair, right? If you could take someone who's never accomplished anything, doesn't own anything, doesn't run anything, and put that person in charge of lots of things, well, then we'd have a more equitable, more fair society. And here's Solomon, who, again, a great ruler, is like, no, that's not it. And yeah. I just love the way that flies in the face of so much of what we hear today. Which is like, oh no, we should. I don't know what the plan is, but the plan is that, like, the wise should be brought down, you know, and those who aren't wise should be lifted up. And Solomon's like, no, that's terrible. That's the worst possible outcome.
Yep. Thank you. No, and that's exactly right. And that also goes with, if you think of being in a position of authority or you're the king, it's easy to kind of neglect things and let things fall apart and decay. That's sort of the natural impulse of all creation. But it's actually hard to build up and create things and make things work. That takes a lot of effort. Okay, verses 8 to 10. These are all in the context, as Jake pointed out, of why should you not leave the place of a ruler who's speaking angrily at you, right? Which is, of course, our impulse. Your boss is getting angry at you, I'm leaving, right? You get upset and you leave. And what he's saying is, don't get upset and leave in a hurry. We'll look at the options for leaving, which is definitely there. But here he talks about the consequences in these next few verses. He presents four different pictures of a person engaged, or four different pictures of people engaged in a work of a destructive nature. And it's not bad work necessarily, but it's certainly destructive. So let me read those and you can see them. Yet he who digs a pit shall fall into it, and whoever breaks down a wall, a serpent shall bite him. He who breaks up stone shall be hurt by them, and whoever cleaves wood shall be cut thereby. So the work is digging, breaking, cutting, and due to the very nature of this work, the person incurs injury, falling, being bitten, hurt by stones, injured by cuts. And these are pictures of inevitable consequences of certain actions, and speaks to the need for care when approaching this type of work. Okay, and remember, the wise person, or the person that is rebuked by the king, the question is, in some sense, how is he going to respond? Is he going to get angry and leave, or is he going to be wise and circumspect and stay until an appropriate time? Okay? So, I'll read a quote from Ginsberg here, so bear with me. It's a little, probably slightly older sounding than my speech, which is good. It makes mine seem more modern. Okay, the 12th verse, which concludes with the counsel given in verse 4, and the 12th verse, I'll just say what that is. The 12th verse is, the words from the mouth of the wise man gain him favor, but those from the lips of the lips of the fool destroy him. So that verse is in response to verse 4, which is, if the anger of the ruler is kindled against you, quit not your place, for gentleness prevents greater outrages. Okay, so the 12th verse, which concludes with the counsel given in verse 4 with respect to the advantage of submitting patiently to and of conciliating the anger of the ruler, shows beyond doubt that the intervening adages in verses 8 to 11, which is the digging and the cutting and the breaking, are designed to set forth the dangers to which the opposite conduct might expose the suffering subject. Meaning, if you aren't humbly submitting, these are dangers that could come about because of it. Okay? The metaphor for the digging of a pit must have been very striking to those who were familiar with the fact that huntsmen, to secure their prey, dug deep ditches, covered them with foliage, and put some alluring meats on the covering. And when the animals stepped on them to get the food, the cover gave way and they fell in. And that it frequently happened that those who were engaged in this dangerous digging were themselves buried by the falling in of the earth. Hence the admonition that by trying to undermine the despot for the sufferings he inflicts upon us, we may be utterly ruined in this hazardous process by bringing upon ourselves the whole weight of the tyrant's anger. Whereas gentle submission will prevent greater outrages. I'll read the next bit too, but all four are pretty much the same thing. The second adage originated from the well-known habit of serpents to make their abodes in walls. Hence, it not unfrequently happened that when a man went into a house and leaned his hand on the wall, a serpent might bite him. You could see that in Amos 5:19. The danger was infinitely greater when a man inadvertently tried to pull down the wall and disturbed the nest of these venomous reptiles. I think he means to say he pulls down the wall and inadvertently disturbs the nest of the reptiles. So thus, by attempting to destroy the fabric of despotism, we may provoke the deadly poison of the tyrant, whereas gentle submission will prevent greater outrages. Okay, so again, he's using these four examples to show, hey, there is a fabric in place, even though it has inherent dangers in it and inherent problems. When you try to pull that down, you're bringing danger upon yourself. Okay? So in other words, if we try to undermine and hurt an outraged tyrant, we will bring dangers upon ourselves that could be avoided by the gentle submission we see in verse 4 and the words from a wise man's mouth in verse 12. Okay, verse 11. If the serpent bites without enchantment, there is no advantage to the charmer. So in this verse, we see the inducement to think and plan before taking any of the actions described in verse 8 to 10. In other words, if we are going to leave the employ of our despotic ruler, we do it carefully, thoughtfully, and you might say, charmingly, right? So if we want to leave his good graces, we can do that. We just want to be wise about it, right? You just don't go in swinging with a hammer. Proverbs 16, 21 to 24. It's another great proverb. It's funny, Proverbs were not written by Koheleth. That was Solomon. It's kind of a joke, Ed. They're both Solomon, but, you know, he doesn't call himself Koheleth. All right. Proverbs 16, 21 to 24. The wise of heart is called discerning, and the sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. So when I first read that, I think, oh, the sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. that's maybe a negative thing, right? Someone who's got a honeyed tongue or whatever. But if you look at verse 23 and 24, the heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. So the wise man, if you think about it, he adds sweetness to his speech and he desires and tries to add persuasiveness to his speech. His words are gracious and, again, sweet to the soul and health to the body. So again, the wise man thinks about how he speaks, how he's saying things, and he intends to make it persuasive. It's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Okay? The truth isn't always hard to hear. Okay. Verse 13, and to round it out, verse 12 there, I'll read it again. The words of the mouth of the wise gain him favor, but those from the lips of the fool destroy him. So you're sitting there in front of a despotic ruler. He gets angry at you and yells at you, tells you to do something that you don't want to do or whatever it is. The wise man is able to speak in a way that gains him favor. Things go well for him, as opposed to the fool who speaks out and destroys himself. The beginning, to the fool, the words, but the lips of the fool destroy him. The beginning of the words of his mouth are folly, and the end of his words, the end of the words of his mouth is mischievous madness. The fool also speaks much, though no man knows what shall be here, nor what shall be hereafter. Okay. Again, the conclusion to the exhortation to stay in your place and not be moved when a tyrant is angered at you is shown here. Wise words will win you favor, but talking impatiently and voluminously is foolish and leads to madness. In verse 14, we also see that the fool believes he knows the outcome of what he is doing, but the wise person trusts in the structure God has made, or trusts in God to maintain his structure and order of things. Consequently, he stays in his position and learns to discharge his duties in an inoffensive way, trusting in the timing of the Lord. This isn't to say he never plans to leave his employ, but that he doesn't do it impatiently or hurriedly. He does it in a way that allows his exit while remaining in the good graces of the leader. Okay? So anyone ever have a job where your boss didn't treat you that well and you wanted to leave? Right. I would be shocked if you've gone through your whole life and not had a bad. Excellent.
Look at this guy.
See? Wise words. Okay. Okay. So, the reason Solomon's writing this about kings is because yes, it applies to kings, but it also applies to anyone in authority, right? Authority to kings were given by God, and then all authority comes under those rulers. We saw that in chapter 2 or 3 or 4, right? So, again, these truths apply for us. So if we're going to leave a job because we don't like working for our boss, that's okay. But we do it in a way where when we exit, what is said of us, what's spoken of us, the remembrance of how we did our job and dispatched it, is one of graciousness, right? This person did a great job and they moved on, they had another opportunity, whatever, but it's not, wow, this person was a real jerk in the end, or, you know, whatever. Okay? Okay, 15. The work of a fool wearies him because he knows not how to go to the city. This work wearies the fool who doesn't know how to do the simplest thing. So again, the work that's wearying the fool is taking the time and the effort and the energy to figure out how to add persuasiveness to your speech when you're dealing with this wicked ruler, how to respond graciously and patiently in that environment, okay? The fool doesn't bother to do that because it's too much for him. He's too tired to take it on. Two outfits to church. All right. Okay. I'll read one more quote here just because that expression, because he knows not how to go to the city, it's a little odd. So I'll quote Ginsburg here. Okay. Cities, being capitals of all the adjacent country, are much talked of and well known by the surrounding inhabitants. As one who does not know the high road to the capital must be extremely ignorant, the phrase "not to be able to discover the beaten and much frequented track to the town" became a proverbial expression to denote a fool who is ignorant of the most ordinary things appertaining to the journey of life, just as we might say, he has not wit enough to travel on a broad open highway. I've never heard that expression, but I have heard the expression, he couldn't plan his way out of a paper bag, right? It's pretty simple. You open the top and you leave, right? Or tip it over, I don't know, depending. But nevertheless, it's not hard. There's a couple of steps and you're out. But that's the idea here. He doesn't know the most basic things and doesn't take the time because he's too tired or too wearied to figure out how to behave and act with this ruler who's wicked, right? He just gets upset about it and leaves. Okay. Verse 16 to 19. Woe to you, O land. So think about what do you think this is talking about? How you would paraphrase these verses, okay? And I'll ask some of you to give me your paraphrase. Okay, 16 to 19. Woe to you, O land, when your king is childish and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is noble and your princes eat in the proper time for strength and not for feasting. So is there a right time to feast? Or a right time to eat? Yeah, for sure. Right? There's a right time to feast. There's a wrong time to feast. Through slothful hands, the roof falls in, and through lazy hands, the house leaks. They turn bread and wine, that's the rulers, which cheereth life, into revelry, and the money of blank is made to supply both. Okay, how would you try to capture the essence of what he's talking about there? So, woe to a land when the king is what? Childish, yeah. And how does he display his childishness, his foolishness?
Eating for drunkenness.
Yeah. So if you could feast for strength, we could call that an appropriate feast, right? But he doesn't do it appropriately, he does it inappropriately, right? He feasts for some other reason, to satisfy himself, not for strength, which presumably is to do something with. Okay? So that's your woe to you if you do that, if you're in that land and your king responds that way. Happy are you when your king is what? Okay, son of nobility, acts maturely. He's noble, right? And what's that? Okay, educated, well-taught. He knows how to do his role. And we saw that, remember, earlier with the noble should be in a position of authority, not walking on the ground, and the servant should be on the ground walking.
That's so unfair.
That's appropriate, right? And so the idea here is, hey, if your king is noble, he's in the right place, you know, he's part of the structure that should be there, happy are you, and who follows what he should be doing, doing it in an appropriate time, right? The princes eat in a proper time. They do it for strength and not for their own celebration and joy, right? Okay. And then this part, through slothful hands, the roof falls in, and through lazy hands, the house leaks. That's true of a house, right? But it's also true of a kingdom. And that's the idea here. If your rulers are lazy and they're feasting inappropriately just to find their own pleasures and delights, that's what happens to your kingdom. It falls apart. And that's why it's woe to you if you're in that type of a country. You know, like if your Supreme Court justice is, well, never mind. Okay, so verse 19, they turn bread and, well, so it's more of the same, right? They're taking bread and wine, which should be enjoyed and appreciated in its proper place and time. They turn it into revelry. Okay, they make it into partying and pleasure seeking. Okay? Now, this final verse, still, do not revile the king, even in your thoughts. And this is, again, that king who was angry at you, right, at the very beginning. That king who's angry and harsh with you, don't even revile him in your thoughts. Do not revile the prince even in your bedchamber. For the bird of the air conveys the report, and the winged creature tells the story. Okay. So 16 to 19 we could summarize as what? Oh, you guys kind of already did that. So I'd say there's a proper time to celebrate and a proper time for consequences to befall a man. In verse 20, which we just read, however, the very depravity and tyranny of the sovereign and rulers ought to make us very cautious in speaking against them, as no mercy can be expected from such an administration. To be plain in that type of environment would be dangerous. No matter how hidden and safe we may think the place where we speak, the secret will escape. There are spies in our families, in our innermost room, who will report it. It will creep out in some unforeseen and surprising way, as if the bird which settles upon the window listened to what was said and conveyed it to the despot. So similar expressions in our language might be, the walls have ears, or hedges have ears, or the walls will speak. Things like that. And that's the idea of the little bird. Yeah, Jake.
Yeah, I love this. I think probably in my parents' generation, people were familiar with the expression, a little bird. How'd you find out? And they'd say, a little bird told me, right? And in their parents' generation, people actually might have known that this came from Ecclesiastes. But I love that. I want to get that back into our language and back into our lexicon. And I just, in today's, what I was going to say is that in today's, like, social media world, that little birdie doesn't have to fly very far. Like, the stuff gets out. And if you're just spewing foolishness out of your mouth or through your fingertips, it's just amazing how quickly everybody finds out everything and be like, oh, well, I heard you didn't like this, or heard you weren't happy with this. And that just gets out. And this is such a wonderful call to be wise about that. So,
yes.
Thank you. I'm
trying to draw a bird here.
I can draw one.
Okay. I was just thinking when you said that, and this is not related at all. This is just one of those coincidences. But Twitter, used to be a bird, right? And so it's kind of like things get out and spread in that way. Yeah. And then now the logo is, although it's free speech. So, like I said, totally unrelated. It's just coincidental. No. Interesting thing.
Just the warning, very apropos for the world we live in. Like, stuff gets out faster now than ever. So, careful what you say or what you complain.
Speaking, yeah.
You get your own word. I mean, if you say it in secret, you're going to say it at some point. Not so secretly either. I mean, if it's in your heart, you're going to share your own information at some point, too.
Yeah. That's absolutely correct. And also the exhortation then goes back to the very beginning, right? If you're angry, dwelling on that, even in your thinking, it's going to come out and you're going to end up telling others and or telling the ruler directly, in which case you're getting the axe and you're getting his anger poured out on you. Thank you, Charlotte. I'm not sure that was much better than mine, but... It was. Thank you, Charlotte. I was embarrassed. It was so good. Okay. So to summarize, we're to be patient under foolish leaders, knowing that God has designed things to return a man's work unto himself, though we don't know when this will happen. So as we went through this, and I put down on your sheets here, I'm sure most of these end up in the trash, but hopefully you read them and try to write out the summaries, because it's actually very helpful for you to understand the flow of the passage. So how I would summarize verses 1-3, though a little folly destroys much good, wisdom will guide and protect you. Verse 4, remain patient under an angry ruler, for though... 5-7, it's evil when a ruler perverts the order of things. 8-11, it is part of God's design to return a man's work unto himself. 12-15, don't be in a hurry to speak out. For 16-19, there is a proper time to celebrate and a proper time for consequences to befall a man. Verse 20, therefore wait patiently for God's timing. Do not curse the king, even in your thoughts. Okay, so at the last few minutes, I thought you could tell me if this chapter is about the major impact of tiny things. If you look at that thread throughout the chapter, including the last two verses of chapter 9, what are some of the small things that we see having a major impact? Wise.
Flies.
Yep. Verse 1, you see a small fly destroys the ointment, right? Okay. What other small things?
I don't know if it's small, but people in positions that they're not suited for.
Okay. Yeah. One fool. Yeah. One inappropriately placed person, something like that.
How much damage can they do?
Yeah. Especially if they're like the county engineer. What?
I said they could warn the whole game. He said warn.
Yeah. There you go.
Other county official, yes. Yeah. Same thing.
Okay. Other verse 8. What small thing do you see in verse 8?
Well, so for me, that section made me think of what Jake was saying about modern times, you want to flip the order around, and that these verses 8-11 are all about unintended consequences. That, you know, kind of there's that parable where a progressive finds a wall in a forest, they want to tear it down because there's no point to it, but a conservative is like, we need to figure out why this wall's here before we do anything to it. That's what I was reading into this.
Oh, totally. No, absolutely. I don't think that's contradictory to what we're saying. There are unintended consequences. You're intending to do one thing, but there's this hidden danger in tearing that thing down. There's a structure there, and you want to go and tear it down because you don't like it or you see a problem with it. But yes, when you tear it down,
take the time to discern it.
Yes. Whack it down, something's going to happen to you. And that is digging the hole, you might fall into it. Breaking down stones, they might hurt you, etc. Right? So they're dangers, unintended consequences, you could say that, but they're also negative consequences. It's not like, ooh, this happy surprise, right? They're negative things that happen because you went and tore down the structure, disturbed things, right? So, but yes, the snake that bites you, that's another small thing. The fly, and what about verse 11? Verse 11, anyone see the small thing there? Well, that's the, again, the serpent. And then verse 20, that's our little bird, okay? So throughout that chapter, you have the idea that these small things can have a huge impact on whatever you're trying to do, whatever your goal is, and it's unintended consequences, but it's also just the power of a tiny thing. In all cases, a negative thing, at least detrimental to what you were intending. Okay? Any questions on that? Okay, talkative as always. Next week we're not meeting because we have the resurrection brunch. Hopefully I'll see you all there, and then we'll resume chapter 11. So we got two chapters left.